From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today's conversation is about monsters. Movie monsters, mostly, but also monsters in history. The scholar Scott Poole is our guest. He'll guide us through this subject. But what he won't do is give a definitive definition about just what a monster is, because they are so many things. They're creatures and aliens and devils. They're really screwed up humans, serial killers, demented capitalists. Really, monsters, he says, are reflections of our culture. They're expressions of the things that worry us or scare us. So Scott Poole will help us understand the history of monsters and all the forms they've taken over time. And that way you can work out your own definition of a monster. Sound fun? Join us after the news. Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. You can do that online at KUER.org. And thanks. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. We've had monsters in human history for thousands of years, painted on caves, told in ancient stories. They've made their way into novels and scripture. And these days, of course, we see them in the movies. Godzilla is just the latest movie monster. He's this big reptile thingy. But the scholar Scott Poole says that's just one form. There are nauseating monsters and sexy monsters, even elegant monsters. Poole argues that they aren't just a reflection of popular culture. They are born out of history. They're the spooky manifestation of our obsessions and our anxieties. So today in the program, we're talking about monsters, movie monsters in particular, and what they tell us about ourselves. We invite you to join the conversation. 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378. What do you expect from movie monsters? Do they still scare you? Should they? What's the meaning of monsters as far as you're concerned? What are your favorites? Again, 801-585-WEST, the number. And Scott Poole is with us. He is an associate professor of history at the College of Charleston, where he's currently teaching a class about monsters in the cinema. He's the author of 6 books, most recently Monsters in America, Our Historical Obsession with the Hideous and the Haunting. He has a new book coming out in the fall, which we'll talk a little bit about as we go along. But Scott Poole's joining us today from a studio in Charleston, South Carolina. And Scott Poole, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me. Excited to get to talk about monsters today.
I bet. You never get tired of that, do you?
I never really do. I've been doing it for years, and it just never gets old. So, yeah, I'm very excited about our conversation.
When did it start? I mean, you tell this story in the book. You were, I think you were like 8 years old, and your parents banned you from watching this TV show, Shock Theater.
Yeah, Shock Theater back in the 1970s and in fact even earlier was either a late night or Saturday afternoon television program that sometimes had a horror host, kind of a host that would introduce the movie. And they were all the classic monster movies from the Universal Studios era plus others. So Dracula, Frankenstein, The Bride of Frankenstein, Wolfman. And, you know, I absolutely became obsessed, obsessed to the point that, you know, I was having nightmares, but enjoying it so much that I'd watch it some more so that I could have some more nightmares. And so eventually, my parents, you know, almost literally kind of pulled the plug on that. Star Wars came around like the next year, and I had a whole other set of gods and monsters to be fascinated with. But then, you know, by the time I'm a teenager, we're in, you know, Michael Myers and Freddy Krueger and Jason Voorhees territory. So it all came back, and yeah, it just hasn't really stopped. And I've sort of built my professional life over, you know, being horrified and trying to horrify others, I guess.
You say in the book your parents didn't really understand, and you probably didn't, at least at that age. These things matter to – why they matter to you, why they matter to the culture. But – and we'll get more specific as we go. But broadly, why do monsters matter to us, do you figure?
You know, I think I can reflect on my own experiences as a kid with it just a bit, because I think, you know, in, you know, kind of micro form, it has to do with why the culture is obsessed with monstrosity. I mean, there was always something about it that I knew was a little bit transgressive, a little bit edgy, that, you know, created sort of a sort of intensity, particularly at that age, you know, kind of right on the verge of adolescence. And I think that, you know, for our culture, particularly maybe those periods of time in American history that have been a little bit more rationalized and buttoned down, monsters have provided an opportunity to take a walk on the wild side. They are this – it's almost like we don't expect horror films to be serious.
Yeah.
We kind of assume that they're disreputable in some ways, and that just turns them into this bizarre playground where all kinds of ideas about gender and about race and questions about politics just really get to come out and play. And so, you know, that's why in the book, you know, I talk about monsters, borrowing a phrase from Judith Heberstam, that monsters are like meaning machines.
Yeah.
That they actually sort of – and I literally often picture this sort of strange piece of, you know, Victorian mad scientist equipment that's just sort of pumping out all of these really fascinating ideas and kind of responding to things that are going on in the culture around it.
It's interesting.
I think that's part of it.
Yeah. But you say in the book also that they are monsters or monster narratives, monster stories, are by definition lies and untruths.
Yes.
And that's why we should study them. Explain what you mean.
Yes. Well, I mean, we look at them, whether we're talking about films or whether we're and other forms of popular culture, or even if we're talking about sort of folklore and urban legend, we know that we're only hearing sort of a half truth or no truth at all. We understand that it's fictional, but because we can see through it, it actually enables us to encounter ideas, including very scary ideas, that in, you know, maybe in other more serious, quote unquote, ways of talking about the world, even in popular culture, we're just not quite able to do. I mean, you know, everybody loves a good police procedural or detective movie or action movie. But so many of those things, they're based at least in some way in reality. We can't see through them in quite the same kind of way. And so, you know, monsters become sort of this filter that actually enable us, I think, to take apart some of the ideologies around us that otherwise we're just very comfortable with. It's almost like the monsters make us so uncomfortable that we have to ask deeper and more complex questions.
So we're not really thinking about it consciously. I mean, what we know is that we're delighted by the fact that this is really scary and that monster is really creepy or really big and really destructive.
Right.
But the reason it works, at least the good ones, are because they do connect with something going on with us deeper inside, our concerns and our anxieties. And in some ways, that's like a collective sense of fear, right? Like in a movie theater, when we're all enjoying a big monster movie together, there's something bigger going on in some way, maybe.
Absolutely. You know, one of the things that makes my book a little different than some other attempts to sort of analyze monsters is that they've often been read, you know, primarily as individual psychological experiences. You know, people are into monsters because they become a way to sort of, you know, work through various sorts of psychological neuroses. What I'm saying is that actually because monsters have such a public presence and because different monsters are important in different historical and cultural contexts, then much as you said, it's a collective experience and it's a collective working out of some of these issues that, you know, we wouldn't quite be able to get at in another way. I actually think there's an excellent example of this, the John Carpenter film. I don't know if you're familiar with this, the John Carpenter film from 1988, They Live, which is actually this sort of anti-Reagan era alien invasion film. And the whole story is based on the idea that the main character finds these glasses that enable him to sort of see the real truth of everything around him.
Yeah.
So, you know, he's walking around L.A. and he puts these glasses on and he looks up and he sees this billboard that's for like a credit card or a bank or something. And what's really there is the word obey.
Right.
And he, you know, he looks at an advertisement for a vacation to the Caribbean. And what it really says is marry and reproduce.
Right.
And this and this leads to kind of a traditional kind of invasion of the body snatchers sort of idea that he also sees that certain people are aliens and others aren't. That's sort of the monster story side of it. But it's almost a perfect illustration of this idea of the monster as a way of taking apart the ideologies in our culture that we might miss in other kinds of forms, just because the monster's so fantastic, just so out, you know, over, out and beyond the edges. They really enable us to have those kinds of conversations.
You know, what's fun about that is not to say John Carpenter's films lacked subtlety, but this isn't exactly a subtle way of talking about the Reagan administration. The better directors were, I think, they were able to hide that message sometimes a little bit better, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, often that's true. I mean, one of the interesting things about Carpenter is he's part of this whole wave of directors, of horror directors after the 1960s, really starting with George Romero, who often did include, you know, fairly progressive, often very subversive messages in their films. A lot of times their movies are really kind of subverted urban legends. And, you know, urban legends are often essentially, you know, sort of conservative cautionary tales about, you know, this is the way you're supposed to behave.
Yeah.
One way I think about a lot of horror movies in the 70s, 80s is they sort of took those stories, changed the meaning of them in some interesting ways.
Mm.
So another example of that drawn on Carpenter would be, you know, Halloween, the original Halloween, essentially draws on all these urban legends from the 1960s about babysitters and babysitters in danger. And almost all of these sort of gave the message that, well, you know, you always have to worry about the babysitter and the kid at home. There's going to be a scary man upstairs. She's not going to take care of the baby, et cetera, because young women are irresponsible, just like all those hippies are irresponsible. Well, Carpenter takes this story, this urban legend. He turns it into a movie in which the babysitter, Jamie Lee Curtis's Laurie Strode, essentially becomes the action hero, the monster fighter. She's the one that defeats, you know, Michael Myers at the end.
Yeah.
And so I think that, you know, often these messages were much more subtle than something that you would find in They Live. But whether they're subtle or kind of in your face, they do become this kind of collective conversation about issues that are very culturally important to us.
You know, you write about this. There's this story before the movies came around. This was from 1817, mm-hmm. and there was this fishermen in Gloucester, Massachusetts.
Right.
Somebody saw something in 1817,
right.
and it became this. You describe it as this highly public, highly social experience. And I wanted you to talk about this because it emerges out of this era that's going on related to violence, to American violence.
Yes.
Talk about that.
Certainly. I mean, monsters are obviously much older than the movies, as you mentioned in your introduction. And in the 19th century, the American monster obsession was the sea serpent.
Yeah.
And when I say obsession, I mean claims dating from the 1810s into the 1880s of sightings by whaling ships and by coastal communities. This incident in Gloucester, Massachusetts in 1817, allegedly hundreds of people saw whatever this thing was that they thought that they saw. There's even popular music by the 1840s and 50s. Of course, back during that time, you know, if you loved a piece of music, you bought sheet music, mm-hmm. Sheet music that you would take home and play on the piano in the parlor. And, you know, sort of the digital download of the day was buying sheet music. And one of the most popular one of those was called the Sea Serpent Rag. And was, you know, this kind of celebration of this idea of monstrous creatures. But the thing that one of the things that fascinated me in learning about that is that, of course, that it was such a huge cultural obsession that lasted decades. But then also the fact that it was almost always connected to frontier violence, the maritime frontier. The frontier of the American backcountry itself, mm-hmm. because there's also kind of a lake monster fascination during the same era. And some of the discussion that surrounded these sightings, and including this incident that you mentioned in 1817, that's now just become known as the Gloucester Serpent, the Gloucester Sea Serpent. Many of these sightings, the response in the popular press and from, you know, sort of amateur scientists who would comment on this was, well, we, you know, the thing we need to do is we really need to kill it.
Yeah.
there wasn't an effort to, you know, let's capture it and let's study it. When they see the Gloucester Serpent back in 1817, they set out in their boats with muskets and harpoons, and they're going to kill the monster. And that sort of clued me into something that I saw in a lot of other 19th century American folklore about monstrosity, which is that, you know, Americans were really tying monsters very closely to kind of the almost mythical dark forest that they thought of as being the American frontier, the maritime frontier as well. And, you know, this plays out in American slavery. It plays out in the American Civil War, where you have both sides accusing one another of you know, various kinds of barbarous, monstrous deeds. In the late 19th century, the outbreak of lynching, which really continues – the lynching of African-American men, which continues from really the 1870s into the late 1940s, in some ways beyond, into the Civil Rights era, that was often informed by imagery of the monstrous. In fact, imagery that, as I show in the book, often drew directly from the story of Frankenstein.
Yeah. You know what? I want to ask you about that because this
always
is
a close connection with violence.
Well, this is the thing you've taught. This is you're showing the 1931 film Frankenstein in your class right now, and it's interesting.
I have.
And you've talked about the fact that an audience that sees that film today. You know, right. we bring with it our own sort of cultural perceptions, the things that we came of age in a certain cultural era. And so we will see the 1931 version of Frankenstein in a certain way. But what's so interesting about that is so we feel a sense of sympathy for mm-hmm. the beast. We, you mm-hmm. know, we feel a kind of there's got to be some interesting backstory related here. Mm-hmm. But when that film was created in 1931 – They didn't think that way necessarily about the monster.
Right.
They had a different sense of it. And I think that's interesting. Talk about that part, because I think that sort of conveys this idea that we see monsters differently depending on when we see them.
Sure. Two things happen when I watch – well, I often watch the 1931 Frankenstein and then the 1935 Bride of Frankenstein, which is largely because it's – probably my favorite horror film, so I always try to sneak it in. But two things happen with students who, you know, are about 18 to 23 years of age, you know, millennials. And one is they say, well, this was fun. They do often find it fun, but this wasn't scary at all.
Yep.
And two, their entire sympathy is with the monster. And I think that's interesting for a couple of reasons. One, it was scary in 1931 and 1935. People were terrified by these images. I mean, Frankenstein's monster haunted the dreams of many a little kid and many an adult in the 30s. And I don't get the sense that they felt the same kind of sympathy for the monster, even though I think actually the director of both of those films, you know, wanted them to some degree. This really hit me when I was reading about how a lot of critics responded to the Frankenstein films and were saying things like, you know, when the mob, the famous, you know, villagers with torches come after the monster. This one critic said, this seems like nothing so much as a Georgia lynching. And it actually hit me that, you know, as widely distributed as these films were, as common as lynching was, there's likely people, you know, sitting in the theater who at some point had essentially been a lynch mob, had been part of a lynch mob. And so they're going to read the monster as a terrible threat. And maybe it's unfortunate that he had to be destroyed, but he had to be destroyed nonetheless. And I actually think this may partially go toward explaining why that is not a set of images that are as frightening to my students today or to my generation or even the previous generation. It's just simply not pushing those same kinds of buttons. I tend to feel that it's not the paranormal stuff, the jumping out of the closet kind of stuff, even the blood and the gore that can really get to people when it comes to horror films. I tend to think that it's when it truly makes people uncomfortable is when it is touching on issues that they are frightened of in the real world. Or that they have, some kind of connection to.
You know, you often hear that hypothetical. What would happen, especially when you're in a blockbuster, like in an IMAX theater with the 3D glasses on, and you often hear this hypothetical expressed that what would happen if you could transport somehow a person from the 1930s to this modern day cinematic experience? You know, would they be? You know, would their head explode? Would they be terrified, or would they be disgusted? Or, you know, have you ever thought about that? How that would translate?
Absolutely. And you know, I think I share sort of the common what would be kind of the common response to that they would be overwhelmed by the technology in the same way that they would be overwhelmed by an iPhone. But I don't necessarily know that our monsters would scare them in much the same way as their monsters don't quite scare us.
Yeah.
They might jump at all the right places. You know, they might, you know, be stunned and surprised at, you know, the amount of gore and general effusion of bodily fluids that are a part of a lot of, contemporary horror. So they might have that sort of reaction, but they wouldn't have quite the same feelings of terror that I think that we might expect and that maybe they even had when they were watching Frankenstein and when they were watching Dracula. You know, one example of this, I think, is the unbelievably powerful, really volcanic response to The Exorcist when it appeared in 1973. I actually showed my students this week some outtakes of visits to theaters in kind of the first weeks of that. And people were scared, but they were not scared in the way that you know you just expect from a horror film. That they were in sort of near hysteria,
yeah.
And you know, we know that people, like, you know, reported weeks and months of nightmares after seeing that film. There was a large public discussion of it from both religious leaders and psychiatrists. And I think that that's an example of how a film, how a horror film can touch on some really deep issues. And the Exorcist obviously pushed the religion button, which seems to have, you know, been the thing that really bothered people.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's also allusions in it to youth culture, allusions in it to the Vietnam War, allusions in it to the difficulty of trusting institutions that you, you know, think you should be able to trust. And this is, you know, right in the middle of Watergate. Hmm. And so, you know, I think that that is what goes, you know, it's sort of one thing to jump when something jumps out at you, the sort of haunted house roller coaster experience. Mm-hmm. I think, though, that certain films at certain moments take us to a very different kind of place, creates a different kind of discomfort that I actually think is useful. I mean, part of I don't suggest that any of this is bad. I think that it actually, you know, shakes the ground around us in a way that's very useful.
Scott Poole is with us, professor of history at the University of Charleston, author of the book Monsters in America, Our Historical Obsession with the Hideous and the Haunting. He has a new book coming out in the fall about the iconic cult horror figure Vampira. We'll talk a little bit about that a little bit later on the program. In the meantime, you can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radioWEST@KUER.org. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about movie monsters. The new Godzilla movie is getting mixed reviews, but it's a decent enough excuse to talk to the historian Scott Poole, who's with us. He studies this stuff, the history of monsters and how they say something about what's going on in the world at a particular time, what we're worried about. He has a book called Monsters in America, Our Historical Obsession with the Hideous and the Haunting. You can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radioWEST@KUER.org. Let's take a call from Brad, who's joining us in Provo. Brad, welcome.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to get Professor Poole's response to something I've been thinking about in the last couple of years, and that's the role of the Joker, the character of the Joker, in particular the role played by Heath Ledger. Mm-hmm. And I think that we may have turned a corner in terms of the monster there in popular culture. And what I mean is that, and you know, to piggyback on what you were saying before about there's the most effective monsters are the ones that touch on the existing fears that are out there. And, you know, they're not supernatural or whatever, but there's something that's actively going on. And on one level, the Joker's character very effectively resonates with, you know, the fear of terrorism and chaos and disorder. But there's this other dimension, which is Ledger's performance and Ledger's subsequent story, right? And so there's this sense that the character spills over into reality or articulates with reality in this frightening way.
Yeah.
And these two kind of mythologies about Ledger and the character emerge. One was that the character is more frightening because Ledger's mental illness is somehow breaking through the character. So Ledger's own depression, right? This is the other specter.
Yeah,
not
it's a good
terrorism, but depression.
Yeah.
So Ledger's depression is breaking through. Or
no, yeah, we got it. We got it. Hold on. Let Scott respond to that. I think it's a good point.
It really is a good point. And I think that thinking about the Joker as kind of a modern monster in Dark Knight is very interesting. I mean, he actually has been in a number of different forms. The amazing graphic novel, The Killing Joke, is another good example. I do think that there was obviously in you know, just sort of reading popular culture, there was a response to that character and to that film, largely informed by the tragedy around Ledger. However, I would say this. The Joker in The Dark Knight is an interesting kind of monster to me because, and I know this is a very different reading of that film, but he seems to be the one character in that movie that is interested in telling the truth.
Yeah.
There's a sense in which, you know, without going into a full explication of The Dark Knight, everyone's seen it, but there's a sense in which that film, and you particularly think about it coming out in the aftermath of the Iraq War and the continuance of the war, really the continuance of the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, there's a sense in which that film is about people who are supposed to be looking out and protecting us lying to us. And so everyone from, you know, Commissioner Gordon does it to, you know, at the end, you know, Batman decides, well, I'm going to lie and that's really going to be good for people. The Joker terrifies us on one level because he's a lunatic and a terrorist and seems to have, you know, no boundaries whatsoever. I think he was also a terrifying character just because of his willingness to be, you know, macabrely truthful about the nature of life in Gotham and to essentially say to all of these authorities that were sort of guiding things and rationalizing things, why so serious? You know, I'm going to take apart the well-organized world that you've built. This is something I think we always love about monsters. They take our worlds apart for us.
You know, one thing though that Brad mentions, and I think is worth, and I wonder if this is part of why that worked for him, because he's talking about, you know, Heath Ledger, not the Joker, but also the Heath Ledger dimension, how that sense of reality is giving it, at least for Brad, certainly for others, I imagine, too, a different kind of context. And you tell the story in your book about this film from 1932, a film called Freaks, directed by Todd Browning, I think it was. Mm-hmm. And he uses actual sideshow performers, you know, little people, people with physical deformities, at least one set of conjoined sisters. And when the he's using real figures in this film, and so the studio previews it and you say it's a disaster. So I'm wondering what's the lesson from that, because you know, if movie executives at first figure, you say in the film, well, the public doesn't really have much stomach for monsters, but of course we do. I mean, of course we did. But what is that saying, that we wanted monsters but we didn't want real ones? We wanted fantasy. Is that what we learned from that?
I think that's part of what we learned from it. You know, the interesting thing about Freaks, which comes out in the early 30s, is that, you know, it sank like a stone and disappeared. I mean, in fact, MGM sold it away, and it doesn't really reappear till the 1960s. But people are hating that film and running out of the theater, vomiting and just having all these horrible reactions, at a time in which they are going to see actual sideshows.
Yeah.
I mean, up until the 1940s, the sideshow was one of the, along, you know, with vaudeville, was, you know, one of the, you know, two or three most popular forms of popular entertainment, mass entertainment in America. And yet, when a film is made that attempts to tell the story of the quote-unquote freaks, these performers, places them in a narrative in which they sort of challenge us, challenge our gaze at them, that is what makes people deeply, deeply uncomfortable. And I think that, you know, to go back to Brad's point about Heath Ledger and the Joker, you know, Ledger – had had many, many roles. I actually think about his incredible and increasingly, as the years go by, more and more disturbing performance in Monster's Ball, this amazing film, Monster's Ball, where he commits suicide on screen. And there was a part of his character that was always that harsh truth-telling, putting something in our face that we didn't really want to see. And I think it makes it very interesting, and it's part of the reason why it disturbed Brad and disturbed us and it's disturbed a lot of people, that sort of his final role is one that is really all about tearing down that whole structure of falseness. And so I think that he's right, Brad's right. I mean, that does have to do with its powerful effect. I think our monsters are always tied in to these uncomfortable parts of our social experience and personal experience.
Scott Poole is with us. He is an associate professor of history at the College of Charleston, and he's joining us today from a studio there. And we invite you to join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Brad, thanks very much for the call. We'll take more calls when we get back from a break. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the historian Scott Poole. We're talking about monsters, movie monsters, and we invite you to join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We're running out of time, but I'm hoping to get to as many calls as possible, so let's try to move through some of these as quickly as we can. Granger is with us in Salt Lake City. Granger, welcome.
Hi, thank you.
Sure.
May we talk about use of music in film? I teach at the University of Utah, and we use one of Aaron Copland's books as a text, so movie music becomes a powerful chapter. Specifically, the Dracula film with Bela Lugosi and the Frankenstein film with Boris Karloff, these two films have no music, whatever. So I do a little before a control group, experimental group thing where we show scenes from the movies without the music, and then we get a lot of laughter because what was scary or dramatic in the 30s is funny, silly, and pale to our movie-going mind today. So I play these scenes back with music accompanying the scene. And then the students say, oh,
that's different.
I'm frightened, or now I get it. Now I'm emotional. I understand.
Well, Scott Poole, what do you make of that?
I think that's a Granger. I think that's really interesting and an interesting experiment too with your students. I had the experience recently in class of showing the original Friday the 13th from 1980. And it was so much fun because they were absolutely terrified and and just screaming at this film that was 35 years old. And, you know, one of the interesting things about it is that the very well-known sort of sound effect used throughout that series, the kill, kill, kill sort of sound, that became so much a part of the student's response that I remember this moment where it's literally nothing, but there's just sort of a light flashes on a, it's either a mirror or a headlight. And, that sound is used and, you know, half of the class jumped out of its skin and literally nothing had happened except light had shone on a headlight. But you know, I think those musical cues have always been important, and I think they've become increasingly important to horror directors. We were talking about John Carpenter earlier. He, of course, famously, you know, basically did the compositions for all of his films, including the very famous one for Halloween.
Yeah.
And then you can't hear Tubular Bells without thinking about without thinking about The Exorcist and feeling a little creepy.
Yeah, it's true. Let's talk about Godzilla, since it is the movie monster now playing. It's so interesting how malleable Godzilla is as a creature, how different filmmakers have shaped it, as you put, into different things. The original film, of course, is Japanese, 1954, and it's right. all related, well, mostly related, certainly based in all of these concerns about the, you know, the nuclear age, and obviously right. Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I mean, that's right there. But then the Americans make another version of it. I think it's like the year after that. They completely strip out all the mentions of nuclear concern, and it just becomes this monster thing. But that's so interesting. Talk about that.
Oh, yeah. America's relationship with Godzilla is fascinating. I mean, as you said, Gojira, the original Japanese film, came out in 54, and it is completely full of references to not only Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but to the war itself. The U.S. is responsible for raising Godzilla because of nuclear testing. There's actually a reference to an actual incident that took place with a Japanese fishing boat. That's how Gojira begins. Mm-hmm. 1955, the American remake is actually a splicing together of scenes from Gojira along with some new footage with the then popular folk singer Burl Ives.
Burl Ives, right.
in it, to give sort of an American voice. The United States did this again in a much hated remake of Godzilla in 1997, 1998. It was a Roland Emmerich film who... You know, he, of course, did Independence Day, 2012, sort of known for doing these sort of disaster movies, what I heard a film critic recently called devastation porn. That's kind of his area. And this film was so interesting because it used the idea that Godzilla had been raised by a nuclear test, but... Guess what? We didn't do it. It was the French. It's it's the fault of the French that Godzilla has come along.
Right.
And I just very recently took me a week or so to see the new Godzilla, and I didn't, you know, I won't give, you know, this will be spoiler free as much as possible because I know a lot of people haven't seen it yet, but there is also in this film a distancing of responsibility between the United States and the possibility of raising this, you know, essentially an atomic monster. I mean, it's impossible to imagine the creation of Godzilla as a monster without the dropping of the A-bomb in 1945. I mean, that was, you know, what he meant. But we loved him as a big, giant monster. Mm-hmm. And so keep bringing him back. And it's very interesting that in this latest, I don't think this is giving away too much. Anybody who's heard about the film at all knows this. It's really interesting that in this latest iteration, he's basically our pal. I mean, he's kind of fighting on our side against the other bad monsters. It's really a good example of how, you know, when you move monsters around in different historical contexts, when different agendas, when really different ideological needs get a hold of them, they become very different creatures.
It seems like it mutes the impact. I mean, one of the things, like I said, this film has received mixed reviews. And maybe it's just that the people who didn't like it didn't think it was an artful presentation or whatever. But I'm wondering if also if a director can't properly use the cultural anxieties, you know, the context of what's going on, mm-hmm. it doesn't have the same sense of stakes, and it doesn't have the same impact. We were kind of talking about this earlier.
This is absolutely true. I mean, it's you know, it's possible to make a good monster movie, a good horror movie, good effects, have a couple of, you know, good opening weekends. There's not going to be a lot of discussion about it after that. You know, we're still talking about The Exorcist, you know, 40 years later, more yeah. than 40 years later. Mm. And I doubt that's going to come to an end anytime soon. So I think you're absolutely right. I mean, the really great horror films that live, that still scare us, are the ones that are able to tap into the terrors of the moment.
You know, talking about the terrors of the moment leads us to what effect 9/11 has had on movie monsters. And one thing you've pointed out is that right around that era, we started to see films that had monsters that had to burn the world to the ground, as you've said. It had to be a full-on apocalypse.
Right.
Is that one of the reflections of our fears after 9/11, the impact of that?
It absolutely is. I mean, if you look at the direction that horror films were taking in the late 90s, there were more sort of apocalyptic films already, a lot of that having to do with kind of nervousness about Y2K and the millennium. But it's really after 9/11 that we get this fascination with monsters that literally destroy our entire world. And you see this actually in the popularity of the zombie genre, mm-hmm. Which has been around a long time, but it's really been since 9/11, in the last decade or so, that the zombie's everywhere and the popularity of the zombie is everywhere. And that's actually kind of an interesting example, because the zombie can be funny. The zombie is a very elastic sort of monster. They aren't always particularly scary just mm-hmm. on their own terms. What is frightening generally to viewers about The Walking Dead or the latest zombie film is that they have destroyed the world in which we live. Mm-hmm. The wireless is down, the cable's off, the grocery store shelves are empty, the ATMs aren't dispensing money anymore. What do we do now?
Yeah.
And that seems to be the terror, although I would also claim there's another side to this. There's a kind of delight that people take in that,
mm-hmm.
a sort of notion of, well, now we get to start over.
Well, it's,
and maybe yeah. now we get to become different people.
Well, this idea of just trashing a city, which you mm-hmm. see a lot of these days, and mostly it's because yes. we have the technology to be able to, as a director, to be able to completely blast away any building. But Ryan sends this email from Salt Lake City. He says, digital technology is very consciously driving much of what we see on the screen today, and its only limitation is the budget, which he says means filmmakers need to self-impose restrictions in order to find creative ways to present their monsters and the havoc that they wreck. And he says it's going to require maturity and discipline, which few of them have nowadays. And I'm wondering if you have a – we don't have a lot of time left, but give us your sense of that, the use of technology to be able to just do whatever we want. Are we feeling ambivalent about that as viewers, because we know it's not real? It's just computer generated. We don't have a sense of the stakes.
I think that there is more and more of that, and I think that's also why over the last few years there's been a tremendous amount of interest in indie horror films and a whole subculture that has grown up around them that, you know, don't really use these CGI effects, mm-hmm. that have to depend on, you know, old school, sometimes things like, you know, stop motion and prosthetics and other kinds of things. And it really has to do with the fact that there's a little bit of – there's a distrust of the CGI, because we know that it's like the magician has explained the trick to us. And then I also think that we may be reaching a point of kind of destruction fatigue in a way, because it's not even just our monster movies. It's the natural disaster movies, and it's the superhero epics, and it's just one destruction of an urban environment after another.
Yeah.
And so that may be a kind of obsession that is going to come to an end, not so much because of technology, but because people want to ask other kinds of questions and maybe want to move beyond these sort of apocalyptic feelings that 9/11 and a lot of the other, you know, very frightening events of the last couple of decades awakened.
I want to spend a few of our final moments here talking about your new book, which is coming out in the fall. It's about this cult horror figure. She emerges in the 1950s. Myla Nurmi, she's this exotic dancer and actress and artist, and she invents herself, reinvents herself, as Vampira.
Yes.
Say something about this. This sounds really, really interesting.
Yeah. Myla Nurmi was a sort of hopeful Hollywood starlet who was able to create a character, a Vampira, that borrowed from some of the strangest, some of the oddest byways and corners and basement spaces of American culture at mid-century, a whole kind of underground world, so much so that she created this character for TV that's only popular for – or was popular for about a year, that borrowed from everything from 1950s bondage magazines to – horror films, to the old silent screen era vamp figures. And she almost was literally too much for America at that particular moment.
And the Eisenhower administration, basically.
The Eisenhower years, the years in which sort of the middle class housewife was symbolic of the way women are supposed to behave in the United States. And so she's really blacklisted. I mean, like, her career really ends after about a year, and yet she remained enormously influential in kind of that underground, and she's actually the background for figures that are much more recognizable, like Elvira, for example, Vampirella. The goth movement, elements of post-punk, and almost the whole general idea of sort of macabre satire really goes back to this one very, very interesting woman. Mm-hmm. So the book is Vampira, Dark Goddess of Horror, and it will be out in September from Counterpoint Press. And it's something of a biography, but it's also something of kind of an extended meditation on the meaning of this mostly forgotten woman for what American culture became over the next half century.
That's the historian Scott Poole, joined us from a studio in Charleston, South Carolina. Professor, thanks. Glad to have you with us.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed this.
I should mention we are premiering a new Video West documentary short. It's called Of One Heart. Go see it at videowest.kuer.org. It's the story of Utah dentist Tom Bricky, whose daughter needed an emergency heart transplant. He expected the relief and the joy, but he didn't expect the guilt. Again, videowest.kuer.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.